Chapter 4. In spite of my insouciant response to Sir Hugo, by the time Stoker and I returned to the Belvedere, I was entertaining second thoughts. Not only had the mention of Jonathan and Harry revived the old, desolate feelings of panic and grief, but Sir Hugo's parting words had been none too comforting. After explaining that seats had been reserved for us on the first train the following morning, at his personal expense, he shook us each warmly by the hand, an expression of relief etched upon his features.
"I really cannot thank you enough," he said humbly.
A sudden twinkle had come to his eye.
"And if you find this possible impostor to be not enough mystery for you, you might turn your hands to an investigation of the supernatural variety. The moor is thick with ghosts, you know."
He left off with a laugh, clearly pleased to have successfully shifted the burden of this matter onto our shoulders. Anticipating our acceptance, Sir Hugo had already written to Charles, a conciliatory letter smoothing over their previous contretemps and explaining about Lord Rosemarin's plans for a museum. He had suggested that Charles write to us with an invitation to come and assess his collection, with an eye to purchasing any specimens that would augment the pieces already in his lordship's possession. Charles had been so eager, Sir Hugo told us as he produced the invitation with a flourish, that he had responded by return post, and we were expected the following day. "We ought to refuse," I muttered to Stoker, as we finished packing the oddments we would require. We were in the Belvedere some hours after dinner, collecting the necessary reference materials and tools of the trade.
"Why on earth would we do that?"
he asked mildly, as he surveyed a pair of calipers. "This is a family matter of a most delicate nature," I protested. "It is hardly within our purview."
"Most of our investigations have been family matters, and all extremely delicate,"
he said.
"In fact, most of them have been connected with your family."
"I do not require being reminded of the fact," I replied, in an acidulous tone. I chose a selection of fine brushes, a fresh notebook, and a magnifying glass, and wrapped them carefully.
"Then why the reluctance?"
There was something in his tone, a note that sounded just slightly off, like the string of a violin that has been imperfectly tuned and indifferently plucked. I shrugged. "We have only just returned from the Alpenwald, and Lord Rosemarin has been very accommodating of our absences. I should not like to take advantage of him." I did not confess the truth, that an unease had settled over me, and I was reluctant to chase the ghosts of my past.
"It is hardly taking advantage if we secure specimens for his collection," Stoker pointed out. "I spoke with him after tea time, and he is most anxious to acquire the thylacine if it is in acceptable condition."
I packed my things into a small carpet bag and paused, considering. Apart from the various varieties of fritillary, there were not many fine examples of lepidoptery to be found on Dartmoor, but the Rosemarin collection was a little thin on native British specimens. It was very early in the season, impossibly early, I reflected. It was likely that only Bolloria euphrosyne, the pearl-bordered fritillary, would be in flight before May. Yet it was a sprightly little butterfly, and a group of them might be worth the effort. I took up a box of minuten, the tiny headless pins used by butterfly hunters to secure mounts, and by me to discourage men who tried to hold my hand without invitation. A few tucked discreetly into the cuffs are wondrously effective. I added the requisite killing jars, a tiny packet of cyanide salts, some cotton wool, and several specimen jars and boxes before selecting my favourite net. It was light and supple, crafted of ash, the bag sewn from the finest silk net I could afford. It was a thing of beauty, as much an artist's tool as an implement of science, and I felt something that had lain dormant within me come alive again as I passed my palm over the sleek grain of the wood.
"Besides,"
Stoker went on lightly,
"I should have thought a ghost and a mystery would have been too much temptation for you to resist."
I managed a smile, but Stoker had already returned his attention to his own interests, namely the thylacine. He had unearthed a recent issue of the semi-annual Journal of the Natural Historian, in which one of his colleagues held forth at length on the subject of the elusive Tasmanian tiger, and was sunk in happy anticipation of getting his hands upon a specimen of his own, when I murmured something about a necessary errand and slipped out the door. A short time later, I arrived on foot at the grand entrance of the Sudbury Hotel, one of London's most exclusive accommodations. A pair of doormen, smartly dressed in crushed bottle-green velvet, sprang to attention, but I passed them by, nipping around the corner and down the alley until I came to the tradesman's entrance. I scribbled a quick note and passed it to one of the boys who loitered in such places in hopes of small commissions. I presented him with a shilling, a more than generous sum, in my opinion, but the child had the skinny, pinched look of undernourishment, which he took with alacrity before disappearing into the working heart of the hotel. I had taken the precaution of wearing a veil, and in the ensuing moments I was grateful. More than one waiter gave me an assessing glance, no doubt attempting to ascertain if I had come to ply a very old and specific trade. "If you are looking for a harlot, might I suggest the alley behind the Karnak Hall?" I said politely to the boldest. "Ask for Elsie. She is a friend." The fellow reared back and continued on his way, muttering about eccentric women, which I found rude in the extreme. Stoker and I had made Elsie's acquaintance during a previous investigation, and she was a diligent practitioner of the amatory arts, but only for pay. And since a woman needs to earn a living, it seemed only considerate to send trade her way should the opportunity arise. I was still ruminating on such thoughts when the door opened and a slender figure in a maid's uniform stepped out, casting sharp glances left and right. "I have slipped away, but I can give you no more than a minute before I am missed," she told me. "It is lovely to see you too, JJ," I replied. My friendship, if I may call it that, with JJ Butterworth, lady reporter, was another souvenir of our adventures with the Tiverton Egyptological Expedition and the events that occurred in Karnak Hall. Always in search of a story, she frequently disguised herself in order to gain access denied to her male counterparts. Her favourite masquerade was chambermaid at the Sudbury, a stratagem that permitted her to observe the great and good at close quarters, as well as the chance to examine the contents of their waste paper baskets, private papers, and bedsheets. Each of these, she had explained to me, could tell a story, and the Daily Harbinger paid well for them. She longed for the career of a serious journalist, but her way was too often barred by men determined to keep her out. So, in desperation, she often got her revenge by assuming one of her little disguises and delivering the type of story that a man could never secure. JJ grinned. "Back from the Alpenwald, then? And we are off again in the morning." She lifted her brows. "So soon? On the trail of something?" "Like you? I presume you are here in order to spy upon the Maharani currently installed in the Empress Suite," I said. She pulled a face. "Who told you?" "No one. It was a guess which you have just confirmed," I said, with a touch of, one hopes, forgivable smugness. "I saw your byline in the piece in the Harbinger about her, and assumed she was staying here, and that if I found her, you could not be far behind." "Well done," she said, folding her arms over her chest. "You are a regular Augustine Dupin. Now, I have precisely 2 minutes before the housekeeper comes looking for me and has my guts for garters for standing about yammering when I am meant to be turning down beds. What do you want, Veronica? I wanted to know if the name Hathaway means anything to you. She paused, furrowing her brow. Anne? Married to Shakespeare? Not Warwickshire Hathaways, Devonshire Hathaways, I said in some exasperation. They've a house called Hathaway Hall on Dartmoor. She rolled her eyes. Dartmoor? Nothing but sheep and rocks. Why the devil do they live there? The same reason anyone lives anywhere, I said. Inherited. I gave her a minute while she thought. Watching J.J. Butterworth work through her immense hoard of knowledge was vastly interesting. Stoker had once taken me to a demonstration of Mr. Babbage's computational machines. The whirring and clicking and sharp manipulation of information put me greatly in mind of J.J.'s efforts, her freckled nose wrinkling up as she screwed her eyes tightly closed, thinking. I did hear something, now you mention it, she said, opening her eyes at last. A long-lost father or something. Eldest son, I corrected. That's it. Lost in a shipwreck or earthquake? Volcano, I said. She shrugged. An act of God is an act of God. In any event, he died and is returned, resurrected, as it were. My editor thought it might make an interesting story, but it is not mine. One of the new lads was assigned to it. When did it run? I pressed. It didn't, she said. It was meant to be only a small piece to run early this month, but Boulanger's flight pushed everything aside and heaps of articles were cut for space. I was not surprised. The French General Boulanger, nicknamed Général Revanche, had been at the head of his own political party, one that had nearly accomplished a coup and overthrown the French Republic. His reluctance to fully seize power when he had the chance in January had led to a warrant being issued for his arrest on charges of treason and conspiracy, and he had fled Paris at the start of April. Newspapers had been full of speculation as to his whereabouts and what the French government would do to him if he fell into their clutches. JJ went on. You were just in Paris. Did you see anything of interest? I recognised the sharp-eyed gaze of a hound upon the scent of a hare. No, apart from that appalling erection of Monsieur Eiffel, I assured her. It has not been formally opened. How did you see it? It is impossible to miss, I said. It dominates the city, quite dwarfing the Arc de Triomphe and Notre Dame. It is a beacon of modernism and progress, she began. But before she could warm to her theme, the door opened and one of the errand boys peered out. You're wanted, he said to her, before ducking back inside. I must fly. She bade me farewell, but paused with her hand upon the knob. There is one more thing about your Hathaways, she said. I don't believe it was simply the Boulanger affair that killed the story. Then why was it never published? I asked. She rubbed her fingers together in an unmistakable gesture. Money. Then she vanished through the door without a backwards glance. JJ had sound instincts, I reflected. If she believed her editor had been bribed not to run the story, and he was a bald man with as many scruples as he had hairs upon his head, then it was most likely the truth. And that meant that someone at Hathaway Hall was very keen for the story of the man returned from the dead, not to become public knowledge. Chapter 5. The next morning, Stoker and I were on the train as directed, heading west as the sun rose behind us in a blaze of pink and gold. It was a breathtaking morning to be taking our leave of London, the sky dazzling enough to make us regret the necessity. The fogs had been blown away by a breeze fit to caress the cheek of a god, the earliest of the budding leaves spreading their bright green capes against a soft blue sky. We travelled in comfort, Sir Hugo's arrangements having extended to a first-class compartment and a hamper from Fortnum's filled with every conceivable delicacy. Stoker spent the journey enthralled in the latest Arcadia Brown detective story.
To set the proper frame of mind,
he explained. But the quarterly journal of the Aurelian Sisterhood remained unread upon my lap. I had thought to take the opportunity to catch up on my professional reading, but the vistas beyond my window were too distracting. The red brick chimneys of the city, once unthinkably foul to me, now added a certain charm to the landscape, for all their black smoke belches, and I watched with a little pang as the narrow back gardens of the suburbs gave way to the wider stretches of open country. I was becoming a Londoner at last, I realized in some alarm. It had once been the greatest source of pleasure to put the vast metropolis behind me as I set out again upon adventures in uncharted climes. Now it seemed I hesitated to set foot outside its confines, trembling like a virgin sacrifice on the precipice of disaster. How could I, who had travelled with Corsican bandits and known the pleasures of camping with no other roof than the stars, shrink from a sojourn anywhere in these dominions? It was unthinkable. Had I wondered in horror, lost my nerve? I most certainly have not, I said aloud. Stoker blinked at me over the top of his book. His cheeks were flushed pink, a sure sign that something saucy was happening on the page.
I beg your pardon?
He asked. Nothing, I assured him. I am merely wrestling with a question of spirit. I fear I have become tame. He snorted, marking his place in the book with a thumb.
You? Tame? My dearest Veronica, it would take a better man than I to accomplish such a feat.
I flapped a hand. I did not mean that, I said. I mean the yearning for open country and the freedom of a net in my hand and untilled ground beneath my feet. Apart from uneventful trips to Madeira and the Alpenwald, my escapades these past 2 years have all taken place within the confines of this island. And yes, I have encountered peril, but it is not the same as adventure. He carefully laid the book aside.
Well, if it is adventure you seek.
He reached for me with a singularly determined look. He settled me across his lap, his lips brushing the pulse beat just below my ear.
Sweeter by far than Hybla's honeyed roses, when steeped in dew rich to intoxication. Ah, I will taste that dew.
Stoker frequently resorted to Keats in intimate moments, usually fitting his caresses to the appropriate lines, delivered in his rumbling baritone. I was powerless against the elegance of the poetry, coupled with delicate debaucheries, and I did not refuse him. It was not at all the sort of adventure I meant, but it would do, I decided. Oh, it would do very nicely indeed. The soft and lovely weather of London had subsided by the time we reached the other side of Salisbury Plain, growing progressively nastier until a proper gale was blowing as our train drew into the tiny station, Shepton Parva. The Hathaways, expecting us, had kindly sent a conveyance, but it was obvious from the moment we settled ourselves inside that Charles Hathaway's lavish improvements at the Hall had not yet extended to the stables. It was an elderly vehicle, at least 60 years past its prime, with leaking roof and cracked windows, and a broken-down nag to pull it along at a snail's pace. Outside, the tempest roared, lightning occasionally illuminating a landscape of bleak moorland punctuated by lonely tors. We journeyed into this no-man's land for what seemed hours, and I thought of the man they called Jonathan Hathaway, making such an effort whilst in the grip of injury and illness. Did some primal knowledge in the blood draw him back to the land where his people had lived for centuries? Or had he merely stumbled into a fortuitous household where the lady of the house was prepared to do her Christian duty and entertain strangers unaware? As we drew closer to the hall, I became aware of a growing unease, a feeling not mitigated by the wildness of the landscape. The further we went, the more torturous the scenery, what little of it we could discern from the begrimed windows of the coach. The driver had been a dour sort, communicating only in monosyllables before taking his place on the box, and he seemed content to travel at the horse's painfully slow pace, although only an oilskin cape shielded him from the vagaries of weather. At last, he thumped once on the roof of the coach, calling in a harsh voice, "The hall!" as we paused, either for some dramatic effect or to rest the horse. The miserable creature stood a moment, and just then a sudden flash of lightning showed us our destination, a great monstrosity of a house crouching against the landscape like a beast ready to spring itself upon unsuspecting prey. Stoker, who has been reading this account over my shoulder as I write, has just interjected,
"For God's sake, Veronica, it was a house, large and rather ugly, with a few more gargoyles than strictly necessary, but it was a house."
I have informed him that editorial criticism is not welcome within these pages, and I expect to hear no further commentary upon the veracity of my accounts. I should point out that I have long since ceased sharing my writing with him prior to submitting my accounts to the archive of the Hippolyta Club. He takes umbrage at my descriptions of his physique, as well as any mention of physical intimacy between us. For all of his robust enjoyment of such activities, he occasionally demonstrates the fastidious prudery of a spinster aunt. It is a flaw I am attempting to remedy. In any event, I have banished him to work upon his newest acquisition and expect now to return to my account uninterrupted. A great monstrosity of a house, crouching against the landscape like a beast ready to spring itself upon unsuspecting prey. A faint glimmer shone against three of the windows, but no blaze of light greeted us, no promise of warmth and welcome. In fact, we stood upon the step, barely sheltered from the worst of the driving rain, as Stoker applied himself manfully to a bell pull that resisted his efforts, clearly broken. He resorted to the knocker, an enormous affair of iron wrought in the shape of a ram's head, the Hathaway badge, as we later learned. Stoker grabbed it by the snout and dropped it heavily against the strike plate. The sound of it was barely discernible over the storm, and he was just about to raise it again when the door swung back on creaking hinges. The inside of the hall was scarcely brighter than the tempestuous night, but it was enough to reveal a housekeeper, I presumed, with steel-grey hair coiled above each ear, in a style that had last been popular when Empress Eugenie was a bride. A chatelaine, heavy with keys, jangled at her waist as she moved.
"Oh, I am sorry. 'Tis such a filthy night, we expected you would have stayed the night at the village inn rather than make such a journey. Fair 5 miles it is in that rattle-trap of Tom Carter's," she fussed, ushering us inside and towards a hearth where a single log smouldered.
"It is not the Hathaway carriage?"
Stoker asked.
"Lord love you, sir," she said. "The family have a smart new carriage, but it cannot stand to our rough roads. The axle has been broken twice, and one of the wheels came clear off yesterday. Now stand you there by the fireside," she instructed.
She hurried back to the door, where the aptly named Mr. Carter was depositing our bags. Stoker proffered him a generous coin in gratuity, and he took it, slouching out again and leaving the bags in a heap inside the door.
"Never you mind," the housekeeper said. "I will have your things brought to your rooms. I am Mrs. Desmond, the housekeeper."
She guided us in, clucking a little like a hen over errant chicks.
"The family have retired hours ago, and you must be worn to ribbons. Let me just turn down the beds and have hot bricks put in."
She hurried up a wide oaken staircase. It was unusual in design, carved with decorations I could not quite make out in the gloom. Animals, I surmised, catching a glimpse of pointed fangs. Across the bottom of the staircase hung a pair of wooden gates, to keep the dogs from the upper floors, no doubt. But there were no dogs here now, warming themselves at the feeble fire. In days long past, there would have been a pack of hunting hounds, perhaps a lady's spaniel or two, lolling on a bright woolen hearthrug. Now there were only the bare flags of the hall, upon which stood a pair of tall wooden chairs, enormous things with carved hoods over the tops, and a single suit of armour, rusting sadly in the corner. A large dining table had been set in the centre, not half near enough to the fire for comfort, and a collection of worn sofas and armchairs that looked the worse for moth completed the arrangement. A narrow gallery ran the length of one wall, and I saw Mrs. Desmond's head bobbing above the railing as she made her way to the private quarters of the house. A few odd bits of weaponry were hung upon the walls, and a tapestry frame, stripped of its treasure, showed where something grand had once hung. Picture frames had left their marks upon the stones, but only the nails were left. The room was a ghost of what it might once have been. "So much for Charles and Mary Hathaway's modernizing," I murmured to Stoker. He pointed to the swatches of bright new wallpaper that had been applied to one wall. They were various and hideous shades of mauve, all flowered, and I repressed a shudder. "To do that to this grand old room is a crime," I observed.
"Then do not look at the new tiles heaped up in the corner," he advised.
Mrs. Desmond returned then and led us to our rooms. Theseus sprang to mind as she guided us down passages and up some stairs only to descend others. We turned, we twisted, we climbed. Some of the passages were laid with thick carpets, obviously new. These corridors were dotted with palms and aspidistras in heavy porcelain pots, and the walls, decorated with silks or gilded papers, were hung with paintings of fruit and landscapes, and Mrs. Desmond paused in front of each to recite the artist and subject, obviously having learnt them by rote, and doubtless at Charles and Mary Hathaway's insistence. The sharp odour of new paint hung in the air in these corridors, but when we at last reached our destination, it was in a passageway with bare floorboards and doors painted in a faded, bilious green.
"This is the maiden's wing, and here is your room, Miss Speedwell," she pronounced, flinging open the door.
I could sense, rather than see, Stoker's lips twitching. "Maiden's wing, indeed." Mrs. Desmond went on.
"All unmarried ladies stay here, but at present that is only yourself and Miss Euphemia. She is just down the corridor, and you have only to ring if you require anything," she said, motioning for me to enter. "Your bag has been brought up," she added, nodding to the carpet bag being unpacked by a young maid.
The girl had already placed my clothing in the wardrobe and books upon the bedside table, and she adjusted the hot bricks under the sheets before bobbing a curtsy and scurrying away to the servant's stair.
"Thank you, Mrs. Desmond," I said.
The housekeeper pointed out the location of the bell pull and bustled away with Stoker, who winked at me behind her back. That little gesture warmed me, and I closed the door to take stock of my bedchamber. It had been furnished sometime early in Victoria's reign, I had no doubt, for there was an austerity to the heavy, dark wooden furniture. It was thickly carved with motifs I could not quite make out, and the hangings were a dark ruby red. There was a needlepoint rug on the floor that might have been stitched by Methuselah's mother, and the cracked bowl of the washstand was lavishly decorated with garish red roses. There were few ornaments, the bulk of them having long been sold, I suspected, and what remained was of dubious quality. But for all its faded grandeur, the house gleamed, every surface polished and waxed to perfection, every cobweb swept, every mantelpiece dusted. Mrs. Desmond clearly took excellent care to maintain the place, and my comfort had been anticipated. A merry fire burned hot upon the hearth, and cans of steaming water had been carried to the adjoining bathroom, where an enormous and ancient tub stood in pride of place. On a small table by the fire in my room, a covered tray waited. I lifted a dome to release the fragrance of hot chicken pie with vegetables and fresh bread. There were cups of custard, golden and eggy, and I knew if Stoker had a similar tray, he would be making low whimpers of pleasure. In spite of the luxurious hamper on the train, I was hungry, the cold and wet trip across the moor rousing my appetite. I fell upon the food like a starveling, making short work of the late supper. My ablutions were swift, for the water had cooled as I ate. As I toweled myself dry, I cast an eye towards the bed. It was narrow as the devil and hard as a rock, stuffed with horsehair, I decided, after an experimental bounce. The resulting shriek of bedsprings sounded like the proverbial banshee, and I realized that any private demonstrations of affection with Stoker would have to wait until we returned to London. Stoker had, upon more than one occasion, remarked upon my vocal expressions during lovemaking, which tended toward the exuberant and audible. With his natural delicacy, he would never attempt to engage in activities which might be overheard, and I was keenly aware of young Euphemia, no doubt slumbering peacefully somewhere along the same corridor. I climbed into my high, narrow bed and burrowed into heavy sheets that smelt strongly of lavender. I might have appreciated Stoker's presence as a platonic bedwarmer, but the hot bricks had fulfilled their purpose, I realized, as I sank into drowsiness. There are few comforts as satisfying as a warm fire, a cozy bed, and a delicious meal after one has been chilled to the bone with wind and rain. Somewhere in the depths of the house, a clock struck the hour and a floorboard creaked. Rain, which had lashed the window pane, settled to a soothing hum. And at last, I slept. Chapter 6. I woke to a tapping upon the door. It was early, the watery light just beginning to fill the room as I sat up in bed. Without waiting for a response, the author of the knock entered, a young woman dressed in a sober gown of dark flannel stuff. Her features were bony, her skin pale and starred with freckles. Dark gingery hair had been plaited and wound to form an untidy coronet around her head. She was tall and slender and carried a tray in her hands. A teapot sloshed as she set it down with a bang.
"Good morning," she said, coming near to the bed. "I am Euphemia Hathaway, Effie to my friends."
"Veronica Speedwell," I said, smothering a yawn. She poured a cup of tea and thrust it into my hands, a few errant leaves floating on the top.
"You are the Lady Lepidopterist. I have read some of your articles," she told me, her expression avid.
"Are you interested in butterflies?" I asked, sipping at the tea. It was scalding hot, a rich Darjeeling with a dainty floral note. The Hathaways might live in a desolate and remote place, but they spared little expense in their food and drink, I decided.
"Not at all," she replied. "Flying worms, I call them. But I know where the best ones are on the moor. I can show you if you want to collect some specimens whilst you're here."
She looked awkward, standing beside the bed, so I patted the edge. "Sit and tell me what does interest you, if not butterflies," I invited. She settled herself, and I noticed her feet were shod in ungainly black brogues. A small lace collar had been pinned at her throat, and she tugged it as she sat.
"My sister-in-law makes me wear it," she said with a grimace. "She thinks it makes me look respectable."
I suspected the brogues were not Mary Hathaway's idea. They looked like a boy's cast-offs, and Effie, seeing my gaze, waggled them, clicking the heels together.
They are miles too big, but I stuffed the toes with paper to make them fit, she confided. They are excellent for walking out on the moor. Mary says they are definitely not respectable.
And must you be respectable? I took another sip of the warming tea.
I should very much like not to be, she said,
her hazel gaze holding mine.
I should like to have adventures, like yours. You have seen the world. I read your expedition notes on your Costa Rican trip in the Gentleman Lepidopterist. Granfer used to subscribe to all of the major scientific journals. Your work is superb, she said.
I am glad you enjoyed them.
Of course, I have no interest in Costa Rica per se, she went on. Jungles are no proper place to study stars. I am an astronomer, you see. I must have altitude and very clear skies. I should like a nice Greek island, or perhaps a lovely desert.
Her voice trailed off wistfully. There are plenty of accomplished astronomers on these shores, I reminded her gently. I believe the University of Edinburgh is considered to be a superior institution. You might study there. They have made great strides in educating women. She rolled her eyes.
It would never be permitted. My brother Charles is my guardian, you see, and while I might talk him around, Mary is a different matter entirely. She has plans.
The last word dripped with scorn.
And if one is unfortunately relegated to the position of spinster, one must make oneself useful in every possible way at all possible times.
Such as carrying early morning tea to the guests. I smiled as I held out my cup. She filled it again and settled herself once more on the bed, companionably.
Heavens no, she said, her eyes round. I insisted upon coming myself because I simply could not wait any longer to meet you. You are the first woman of science I have had the pleasure to know. Lady, she amended hastily, lady of science.
I prefer woman, I told her in a mild tone. Lady sounds better suited to a horse. She grinned, a broad expression that revealed white teeth with a tiny gap in the front.
I feel as if we will be great friends, she said, leaping to her feet. That is presumptuous and rude, and I shall be in terrible trouble if you tell, but I do not think you will.
She bounded to the door and stopped, her hand upon the knob.
I am meant to tell you that breakfast is in an hour's time, downstairs in the Great Hall. It is draughty, so mind you dress warmly.
Before I could frame my thanks, she left, slamming the door behind her, a whirlwind in petticoats. I washed and dressed and made my way down to breakfast, making only two wrong turnings as I followed the aroma of fried ham and the sound of masculine voices. The table had been pushed near the fire, and it was laden with good country fare. Eggs, kidneys, ham, breads, jams and jellies of every description, stewed fruit, porridge, and thick, fatty sausages that sizzled in the dish. A chafing dish of kedgeree stood in pride of place, and Stoker had taken a large helping of the savoury rice and fish. He was sitting at the table with a young man attired in the garb of a country squire, tweeds and gaiters. His broad face was open and friendly, the auburn hair brushed back from a high forehead that would grow higher with each passing year, I had no doubt. His plate was heaped high, and I could see where the buttons of his waistcoat were straining slightly. He had put on weight recently, I deduced, and would no doubt gain significantly more if he continued to eat like a gannet. He leapt to his feet as I approached. At the foot of the table, a diminutive young woman kept her seat. Her hair, almost white blonde, had been pinned firmly under an exquisite lace cap, and her wool dress, perfect for a chilly country morning, was a rich bottle green, trimmed in fashionable Parisian passementerie. A pair of luscious pearls hung at her ears, and she wore a tiny lace collar fixed with a brooch of pearls and small garnets. She might be domiciled in the wilds of Devon, but she had no intention of letting herself become a dowdy country mouse. All of this I surmised in an instant, as her husband came forward, his hand outstretched.
"Miss Speedwell, how good of you to come," he said,
taking my hand and pumping it furiously.
"I am so very sorry we were not awake to greet you. We expected you would choose to stay in Shepton Parva on such a filthy night, and besides, we keep country hours here."
He was broad of shoulder and tall, thickly set with muscle that would require exertion to keep toned. I could well imagine him, 20 years hence, fat and bald as an egg, and entirely happy with his life. An air of contentment hung about him, but also a slightly bewildered look, as if he liked where he found himself but could not quite understand how he came to be there. "Thank you for the kind welcome," I told him. "Mrs. Desmond was the soul of hospitality."
"I should hope so," Mrs. Hathaway said placidly. "It is one's duty to entertain angels unaware."
I gave her a smile, intended to hide the fact that I loathed her on sight. There are few things I despise more than people who constantly quote platitudes. It demonstrates a painful lack of originality. Apart from that, she delivered her words with the overly refined diction of one who had been schooled in gentility but not born to it. There was no trace of the Yorkshire Dales in her voice, and while I did not begrudge her the desire to improve herself, I suspected it had been undertaken out of snobbery. I settled myself into the seat allotted to me and applied myself to breakfast. We spoke of pleasantries as we passed platters and bowls and worked our way through the heaps of food. As the last cup of tea was poured, a nanny entered with a string of children. The oldest, a boy, looked to be about 6. He was followed by a girl a year or so his junior. Behind them came a pair of nursery maids, each carrying an infant of some 6 months or so.
"Geoffrey and Ada,"
Mrs. Hathaway said, beaming at her eldest offspring.
"And the twins, Alice and Augusta."
The maids presented the babies like entries in a county livestock show, and Stoker and I made appropriate noises. The children had, at least, all been scrubbed and polished, and no unappetizing aromas emanated from their persons. But the boy had a sly look about him, and the girl, Ada, stared with a gormless expression, her finger hooked firmly in her mouth until the nanny swatted it aside. Mrs. Hathaway surveyed them and gave a nod.
"Nanny, the moor is too muddy for a walk today. Air them in the garden." "But I want to go to the moor," the boy child said, thrusting out his upper lip.
He pulled out a crumpled ball of wire from his pocket and held it up to his mother.
"What have you there, darling?"
she asked, smoothing down his cowlick with a practiced hand.
"A cage,"
he told her with ghoulish delight.
"And what do you need with a cage upon the moor?"
she inquired.
"I am going to catch a fairy,"
he said solemnly.
"Why do you mean to catch a fairy?" "So I can make it give me all its wishes,"
he said firmly.
"What a clever boy,"
his mother said, turning to the rest of us with a fatuous smile.
"And what if the fairy won't give you wishes?"
his father asked, winking broadly at Stoker.
"I shall poke it with a stick until it does,"
his unlovely offspring said.
"I shall poke it in the eye."
His father gave an uproarious laugh, but the child did not appear to be joking in the slightest, and I fixed him with a stern look. "I think," I told him, "you might have confused fairies with djinns."
"I don't know a djinn,"
he said, thrusting his lip out further still.
"Djinns are nasty foreign things,"
his mother assured him. She flicked me a glance.
"If you want a fairy, I am sure you will find one, but not today, darling,"
she added. His face puckered, and she reached into her pocket for a small tin.
Now, have a few humbugs and go along with Nanny. If you are a very good boy, Nanny will take you out on the moor after luncheon when it will be dry, and then you can find your fairy. All right, my darling?
To my surprise, he capitulated, but only after extracting another pocketful of humbugs from his mother and a penknife from his father. He surveyed the tiny blade with feverish pleasure.
I shall poke it in the eye,
he murmured again, as his nanny led him from the room. The girl child followed, sucking her forefinger once more, and the babies, stolid as lumps of lard, were borne away by the nursemaids.
Children are an unparalleled joy, Mrs. Hathaway remarked to me. Of course, being an unmarried woman who works for her living, you are denied such comforts, but you mustn't let that make you bitter, she urged.
Stoker smothered a laugh, choking into his eggs until Charles Hathaway clapped him firmly on the back.
Quite all right there?
Yes, perfectly, thank you,
Stoker assured him. Mrs. Hathaway signalled a maid to remove her breakfast things and turned to us with an expectant air.
We are very glad you've come to assess the collection,
she said, pitching her voice to a confiding tone.
There is so much work to be done on the house, and, frankly, the greatest part of it is clearing away the old rubbish that is practically stacked to the rafters. We have had 4 bonfires already, and carted away 12 loads of dreary old furniture and fittings.
Stoker's expression was pained.
Well, the specimens are not rubbish to Lord Rosmoren.
Charles Hathaway laughed.
Then he's a better man than I, he is. There are all manner of things in the collection, furry and fangy and completely unhygienic, as Mary says,
he added, with an admiring nod to his wife.
She doesn't want them about because of the children, you see. She thinks they will take fright from some of the more outlandish creatures.
But they would be perfect for inclusion in Lord Rosmoren's collection,
Mary Hathaway put in smoothly.
Perhaps with a nice little plaque to say where they were found.
I am certain something could be arranged,
Stoker told her. I turned to Charles Hathaway. I have had the pleasure of meeting your sister, Euphemia, I told him. Are there any other members of the family? It was not the subtlest of inquiries, but then Charles Hathaway was not a subtle man. He would not be offended by a little impolite curiosity, I decided. His sort would happily tell his life story to a stranger on the street. Jonathan had been much the same, I remembered with a pang, ever ready with a smile and an invitation. His friend Harry Spenlove had been the quieter of the two at first, hanging back a little, while Jonathan had been an open book. Charles Hathaway's brow furrowed.
Well, there is my grandmother, Lady Hathaway. My grandfather, Sir Geoffrey, was knighted for his discovery of a comet, he said proudly. But Grandma's health is poor, and she may not make an appearance today. She has a companion, an Indian girl called Anjali. Do ask her if you need anything. She's a useful soul, he told us. Mostly reads aloud to Grandma and sews and listens to Grandma's endless stories about life in India before the mutiny, he added, with another braying laugh. I did not join in. I felt my lips thin at his casual way of speaking of his grandmother's companion. He went on, blithely unaware of my discomfiture. And then there is the man we call Jonathan, he said.
You call him Jonathan?
Stoker asked easily.
Is that not his name?
That is precisely the question,
Mary replied tartly. Charles spoke up.
You see, Jonathan Hathaway was my elder brother. He took up exploring. A bit of lepidoptery, a little mountaineering here and there. Just gentlemen's hobbies, you understand? He was lost in the course of his travels in the Sunda Strait, the eruption of Krakatoa, a nasty business, he said with a visible shudder. We assumed, naturally, that he was dead.
Naturally, I murmured.
But there never was a positive identification, no body to bury, no effects recovered. It was as if he had simply vanished,
Charles said unhappily.
It was a dark time for us all. Grandfather lost much of his enthusiasm for attending to his responsibilities, including taking a proper interest in this old pile,
he said, with a fond look about the room. He went on.
I inherited the house and its contents, except for Grandfather's personal possessions.
And the house was in an absolute state, Mary put in, flapping her hands. Practically falling down, as you can see for yourselves. Just making it habitable has been a trial, and we've months of work left. Only our suite and the nurseries have been refitted with modern amenities. The entirety of the house requires attention, and the flocks have dwindled to almost nothing. Outbuildings crumbling, cottages in need of repair. Charles has made a priority of the flocks, which is why you will no doubt find your rooms a trifle outdated,
she added, colour flaring in her cheeks.
Now, Mary,
he protested, but I had no desire to witness an example of marital discord. Mine is most comfortable, and as clean as if the Queen herself were coming to stay, I assured her. She seemed mollified by this.
Mrs. Desmond is a treasure. I do not think she is entirely happy about all the changes, but then it isn't for her to object, is it? And it will make far less work for the staff once all of the rooms are completely modernized. Of course, Lady Hathaway does not wish hers to be modernized at all, she added with a confiding look. And Euphemia would not notice if she bedded down in the piggery. She cares only for her astronomical instruments, and I am at my wits' end with her. It is such an unladylike undertaking to tax one's mind with science, she said.
I arched a brow, and she went on.
Of course, it is different for you. You are some years her senior, but we might still make a bride of Euphemia, if only we could curb her wilder habits. She is very young. And terribly headstrong, you know, like a moorland pony. But we have broken those to the saddle, and I dare say we can break Euphemia as well,
she added, with a fond smile at her husband. If anything of family loyalty or fondness for his sister gave Charles pause at the idea of bringing his sister to heel, it was obviously overruled by uxoriousness. He merely returned her smile and then beamed at us.
Mary is quite the manageress, he said with apparent pride. But then we need a bit of managing, don't we, my love?
He gave her a fond look and I pushed my plate away. Something volcanic rumbled within me and Stoker must have sensed it. He hurried to speak before I could vent my outrage at Mary Hathaway and her dismissive attitudes.
You were telling us about Jonathan Hathaway's death,
Stoker put in.
You have our condolences.
Jonathan Hathaway is not dead,
pronounced a sharp voice from the doorway. Situated as it was under the gallery, the door was in shadow. And we had not noticed the figure approach. She came forwards, her footsteps shuffling a little as she walked with the aid of a cane. It was a mahogany piece, highly polished and featuring the carved silver head of a ram. She was dressed entirely in black, the bombazine muting any gleam from the morning light streaming through the clerestory windows. The only touch of colour was the white of her hair and the brooch at her throat. A chatelaine, like the housekeeper's, but of rather more elegant design, hung from her belt. She was old, her face resembling a windfall apple, withered and wrinkled, The mouth set in an aggressive line, the chin lifted, and she regarded us with all the imperiousness of an empress. Stoker leapt to his feet, as did Charles. I rose as well, in deference to her age, but Mary Hathaway remained seated. "Mr. Charles Hathaway was just explaining that," I told her. She paused next to me and lifted the cane, prodding my hip.
"Who are you?"
"Veronica Speedwell, and this is my associate, Mr. Templeton Vane."
"They are natural historians,"
Charles said in a soothing tone.
"They are here to look over Granfer's trophies to see if there is anything worth adding to the collection of Lord Rosmoren. I told you about it,"
he added, with the merest touch of reproach. She flicked him a glance.
"I remember, Charles. I am not losing my faculties, but I am sorry to part with Sir Geoffrey's things. He had a connoisseur's eye."
"If you mean he bought anything that wasn't nailed down and shipped it home, then yes,"
Effie said, coming to stand beside her grandmother. Charles completed the introductions and suggested we begin our exploration of the collection at once. Mary Hathaway excused herself to write letters, leaving the rest of us to survey the trophies.
"I have instructed Mrs. Desmond to open up the long gallery and light a fire. We have kept it closed off to discourage the children from exploring,"
Charles said, his voice rueful. As he led the way to the older part of the house, I fell into step with Lady Hathaway on her slow progress to the long gallery. "You were saying that your grandson Jonathan is not dead," I prompted. She gave a sharp nod.
"I never believed he was. A clever boy, our Jonathan. We never knew him until he was older, of course. He lived in India with his parents. But in due course, we insisted he be sent home to school."
"Are there no schools in India?" I asked innocently.
"None fitting the eldest son of such a distinguished family as ours,"
Lady Hathaway said. Just behind her, Effie rolled her eyes. Her grandmother went on.
"In every generation, the eldest son has attended Harrow, and Jonathan was not going to be the first to break with that tradition. Naturally, his parents agreed and sent him to us. He spent every holiday here at the Hall, learning about his inheritance and the family traditions."
"He would have been a fine heir," she said, her lips trembling slightly. I glanced ahead to where Charles Hathaway walked, wondering if he had overheard. But he gave no sign of it, and I realized he had doubtless heard it all before.
"After his schooling," Lady Hathaway went on, "Jonathan wanted to see the world. We were only too happy to oblige."
"Travel broadens the mind," I remarked.
"Yes, well, in Jonathan's case, it made it rather too broad," she retorted. "He developed a taste for life outside of England. No matter what we did, he found excuses to hair off again, always to the most outrageous of places."
She lowered her voice.
"Places not even coloured pink on the map."
I suppressed a smile. Lady Hathaway might have spent decades in India, but she demonstrated the true provincial's wariness of any part of the globe that did not fly the British flag.
"He met with misfortune during his trip to Sumatra, and when that dreadful volcano erupted, we feared the worst. It has been 6 years, Miss Speedwell. 6 long years. But never did I cease to pray and to hope that one day he would be restored to us. And at last it has happened."
"Really?" I said, in a faint voice.
"It has,"
she told me with a firm thump of the cane.
"A few weeks passed, a storm blew up.
one of the late winter tempests that would try the hardiest constitution of man or beast. It was black outside and blowing a gale when Charles went out to see to his lambs. One had wandered away, and it was a large, handsome fellow. Charles couldn't bear to lose him, so he took a lantern and set off himself. Just at the edge of the garden, where the estate meets the moor, stands the summer house, and that is where Charles found him.
The lamb? I asked.
Jonathan, she said in exasperation, in a state of collapse, fainting with cold and fever just inside the door of the summer house. Charles did not recognize him, of course. It had been a dozen years or more since the brothers had met. But he did his Christian duty and had him carried inside. Mary immediately set to nursing him, having him put to bed and fed hot broth and calf's foot jelly. They did not know who he was, you understand. It was not until Mary read the papers he carried that they learnt the truth. But I knew, the moment I saw him. He opened those great dark eyes and looked straight at me, and called me by name.
She paused and reached up her sleeve for a handkerchief to dab at her eyes. How extraordinary, I said.
Indeed. Of course, he did not know where he was, poor pet. So spent with fever and injury from an accident that it was some days before we even dared to hope he would recover.
Accident? I asked, thinking of Sir Hugo's explanation of a dockside brawl in Bristol.
His conveyance overturned, Lady Hathaway said.
I flicked a glance to Effie, whose mouth thinned in impatience. Either Lady Hathaway had been told a more genteel version of events, or she had lied to me in order to make Jonathan Hathaway's injuries sound more accidental than disreputable.
And now he's home, Lady Hathaway crowed. He's still not himself entirely, you understand, but he gains in strength every day.
Will Mr. Jonathan Hathaway not have some objections to our assessing the collection without his approval? I asked. Charles Hathaway stopped instantly and whirled.
The collection, Miss Speedwell, he said, bristling, is mine to dispose of as I see fit.
He turned back and gestured towards a double door.
In here, if you please.